When everything else is stripped away, when all the things we are attached to are gone, we discover that in the end, only God holds life. It's only God who matters. And His promise is certain. I will never leave you nor forsake you.
That's the Reverend Dr. Alan Hunt. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is a new day of faith and hope. This is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the program that brings you outstanding Protestant preachers from across America, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your world. Now, here's your host, Peter Wallace, to introduce this week's preacher.
Thank you, Sherry. Today we're delighted to welcome back the Reverend Dr. Alan Hunt, Senior Minister of Mount Pisgah United Methodist Church in Alpharetta, Georgia. Alan was educated at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia, and worked in the business world for several years as a management consultant before entering the ministry. He then studied at Candler School of Theology and Yale University. He also hosts The Alan Hunt Show every Sunday evening on our flagship station, News Talk 750 WSB in Atlanta. Alan, we're glad to have you back.
Great to be here, Peter. Thank you.
I understand your grandfather and your great-grandfather and an uncle were all United Methodist or Methodist preachers. As a minister serving today, how similar is your work to theirs, and what are you doing differently?
In some ways, that's a hard question for me to answer, but I never knew my great-grandfather and barely knew my grandfather, know my uncle well. My great-grandfather helped to lead a Methodist newspaper here in Georgia and also pastored Methodist churches and started a Methodist school in Mississippi. So he had kind of broad, almost parachurch interest. And then my grandfather was a pure local church pastor in Mississippi. And then my uncle was a Methodist pastor in Indiana, in the South Indiana Conference. And I've learned a lot from him. In many ways, he modeled for me what I consider to be the noble character of what it takes to be a local church pastor. Frankly, there are a lot of other ministry roles that are easier without the day-in, day-out routine and the needs of people that come up spontaneously that sometimes take away from your family and those kinds of things. And my uncle did it with grace, and he did it with joy, and gave his life to it. And I really admire that, and I've drawn a lot of strength from that.
One unique part of your ministry, as we talked about last week, is your radio program on which you tackle some pretty hot topics, not, as you put it, from a right versus left perspective, but with a right versus wrong approach. But I bet some people are saying you're pretty brave to put yourself out there as a pastor.
Yeah, we talk about a lot of things, Peter, that you really couldn't ever talk about in a sermon. Some are not appropriate for that, and some are just kind of tangential to what you want to do in church. But they're real-life kinds of issues, like people's addiction to porn and how folks have responded to September the 11th and how folks view homosexual behavior and those kinds of things. And we've really created a space where people can come and share their opinions, and they can share them openly and honestly. They'll be treated with respect and dignity and with grace. But I also hold fairly clear, fairly orthodox, traditional, biblical Christian principles and kind of share those. So it's not like anything else on talk radio. It's not preaching. It's not a Bible study. It's not really Christian radio, but it's not talk radio because most talk radio is so political. And so it's really where real life and faith come together. And really, it's been a lot of fun. We've seen the ratings grow. And more importantly, we've seen the kinds of callers really develop into the people that we're most interested in talking to, people who are really kind of exploring faith for themselves, struggling with their faith or struggling with real life issues. It's really been a wonderful mission opportunity.
You also have a MySpace page, and some of our listeners may not know what MySpace.com is, but why is that an important part of your outreach?
Well, I have two teenage daughters. I have a senior and a sophomore in high school, and one of the things that they have taught me, as well as our producer on The Alan Hunt Show, who's 24, is that folks who are younger than I am, I'm 42, most folks who are younger than I am communicate in a different way. And the internet and MySpace and Facebook and those kinds of things are at the forefront of that. And frankly, it changes by the week and by the month. And so on the radio show, we're really trying to reach people that the church oftentimes does not have a conversation with. And MySpace is just one of those ways. Our webpage is another, in multiple ways that we're trying to stimulate conversation with people who otherwise might not come in contact with the gospel.
Well, today you continue your series entitled God's Promises for You. Remind us about the first two promises you've illuminated for us.
The first message, Peter, was I love you, and it was a simple reminder that before anything else, God has an immense love for each one of us just because we are, not for what we do or for any other reason. And the second one was the basic, simple message of Jesus, I forgive you. What wonderful news that in spite of who we are oftentimes, God's grace washes over us, cleanses us, sets us free, and helps us to position ourselves to a future that God has in store for us.
Your sermon today draws from a passage in Hebrews chapter 13. Would you read that for us?
Sure will. Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What can man do to me?
This promise of God comes in the midst of a long list of imperatives the writer has given us, starting with endure trials, pursue peace with everyone, let mutual love continue, remember those who are in prison, and then, as you read, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. What's the writer doing here, and why was it important to remind his readers of this promise?
The people that are being addressed in the letter to the Hebrews, Peter, I think, were undergoing intense persecution, and they were suffering a great deal, not just suffering, but suffering for the sake of the gospel and their faith. And most of the letter, and I think this part as well, is trying to encourage them, don't give up, don't quit, don't let your faith go, stand firm and trust in God's promise. And so he takes it back to that promise really that God made initially to Joshua when Joshua was taking over Moses' place. And Joshua said, you know what, I'm not really up to this role. And God said, don't worry, don't be afraid, I'll be with you, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. And reminding them that promise really undergirds the church, that no matter what we're enduring, God is with us and he will never abandon us. And I really found it interesting, and that's one of the things that I mentioned in the sermon, was that he follows that directly with keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have because God has said, never will I leave you. And again, that tension between where is our ultimate hope, where is our ultimate trust, is it in God or is it really in ourselves or in the things of this world? I just thought that was fascinating as I looked at this passage.
Well, and we look forward to hearing more about this trust in God in your sermon today, God's Promises for You, Part 3, I Will Never Leave You Nor Forsake You. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. We like to joke about it. I mean, you know all the old jokes about the fellow who worked hard, he was financially successful, proud of all of his achievements in life. He told his wife to put all of his money in the coffin when he died so that he could take it and enjoy it in heaven. When he died, at the end of the funeral, his wife walked up. She carefully placed a huge box in the casket right beside him. Her best friend came up to her and said, Sally, you didn't actually do what he told you to do, did you? Well, yes, Sally said. You know, it was his last request and I needed to honor it. So you put all of his money in that box? Yes, Sally said. I wrote him a check. We know all the jokes, and we like to joke about death, but being near to death sure has a way of making things come into focus, doesn't it? That's what Craig and Denise learned. Being in the presence of death has a way of teaching you an awful lot about life. I'm not sure why we humans often only grasp this third promise of God when crisis hits, but here it is. God says multiple times in the Bible, I will never leave you nor forsake you. That is the third promise. That third promise is the secret to life. I will never leave you nor forsake you. As Craig lay in that bed for several weeks and the news seemed to be getting worse instead of better, no answers were coming from the tests or the doctors, he and I talked. And we both knew full well that death was in the lobby just waiting to come in. One morning, Craig shared with me what he had discovered the night before. He said, I've worked hard, I've done well, but right now, that success and all that money, they mean nothing. I've got a lot of good contacts and some close friends, a lot of good people in my life, but right now, people can't help me. I have a child on the way very soon, and it just became clear to me last night as I prayed to God. I have nothing but God right now. It's just me and Him. He holds my life. He holds the future. I can trust only Him, just Him. Today, Craig will tell you that that night in the hospital bed, he learned the third promise of God, Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6, God's sweet voice, I will never leave you nor forsake you. That's the secret to life, to trust God alone. When we really get that promise, when you know that promise way down deep in your knower, it'll revolutionize your life. When everything else is stripped away, when all the things we are attached to are gone, we discover that in the end, only God holds life. It's only God who matters. And His promise is certain. When all else is gone, there still is God. God's sweet voice saying, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. God is teaching us the only place for your trust is in Him. Everything else will fade or let you down. He teaches us that over and over again in the Bible because for some reason we humans have a hard time getting that. Our tendency is to put our trust in things instead of Him. Notice how this Hebrews passage plainly links this promise, I will never leave you nor forsake you, to our attachment to stuff. Right there in verse 5 it says, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have because God has said, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. We tend to attach ourselves to things rather than attaching ourselves to God. That's just what the Israelites did. You remember the example of the manna? God instructed the Israelites that He would supply their needs each day in the wilderness. And yet the first day that He supplied the manna, there they were, trying to gather more than they needed, hoarding for the next day, just in case God didn't deliver on His promise, just in case God didn't deliver each day just like He said He would. So they hedged their bets. And to make His point, God allowed the unused manna to rot overnight, so that they had to learn to depend on Him each and every day. I will never leave you, never forsake you. God provides. God is in control. He will never leave us or forsake us. The Bible's full of people just like that, just like the Israelites, the fool who kept building bigger barns to store all of his stuff, Saul, who became Paul, the rich young ruler, Ananias and his wife Sapphira, just to name a few, people who trusted stuff, trusted things, more than they trusted God. They were convinced that they had life by the horns, only to discover, too late often, that they had trusted in things rather than in God. And we do the very same thing. We accumulate stuff at an incredible rate. So fast we can't keep up with all the stuff. No room for it all. Possessions mean so much to us. We can't let go. We build extra garages for our cars and houses continue to expand. There's now 32,000 storage facilities in the United States with something like 1.3 billion square feet of extra storage because our houses and our apartments can't contain it all. The more we have, the more we need. The more we have, the more we worry about it, and it's never enough. When somebody asked John Rockefeller how much was enough, he said just a little bit more. Because the lesson is clear. Don't put your trust in what you have. Life is not what you have. Hear it again. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Trust God and Him alone. When we don't put our trust in things, sometimes we put our trust in people and human beings and institutions. We trust pastors, we trust leaders, we trust role models. But it's not what you have and it's not who you know. Trust in God, only in Him. Again, I will never leave you nor forsake you. That's the one sure thing, God's promise of His presence. When you really get that promise, it changes your life. So I invite you to do three things with that promise. One, detach from things and attach to God. Detach from things and attach to God. How plain does God have to make it to us humans? 2,350 verses in the Bible are devoted to money and possessions, more than any other subject, because God knows that we are far more likely to trust stuff and things than we are Him. Just pick one verse. I'll take Matthew 6:24, where Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Number one, detach from things and attach to God. Number two, embrace simplicity. Live with less than you can afford. In a credit card-saturated culture that tells us every day to buy more, God's wisdom flies straight into the face of that worldly wisdom. Simplicity. Fewer cars, smaller houses, less spending, less debt, fewer gadgets, lower lifestyles actually lead to more joy, not less. Embrace simplicity. trust God. Number 3, trust the promise. Notice how Hebrews 13:6 follows 13:5 again. Keep your lives free from the love of money. Be content with what you have. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Psalm 118 verse 6 says, we can say with confidence, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can anyone do to me? When we really experience that promise, when we really know that God will never leave us nor forsake us, fear disappears and worry is no more. Life is never again measured by what we have or who we know, because we know the one who holds life, the one who holds the future, the one who provides. In his hospital bed, Craig learned that when everything else was stripped away. Trust the promise, and there you will find life. A few years ago, I was finishing seminary, and I was planning to pastor United Methodist churches for the rest of my ministry, and an opportunity presented itself because of some excellent faculty members that I had studied with. It became possible for me to go to Yale to do a PhD in the New Testament. I'd fallen in love with the Bible in seminary. I loved Greek. I loved reading the New Testament. I loved studying the Scriptures. And only a few people a year were admitted to that doctoral program, and so we prayed about it, and we really believed that God was opening that door. So Anita and I walked through that door, and we moved our family to Connecticut. We weren't sure what lay on the other side. The teaching might be where we were headed, to teach at a seminary, perhaps in a college, or maybe to return to the pulpit. We didn't know. We were a little nervous about the future because we didn't know what God had in store. We were nervous about how we were going to pay for this venture. A family of four, I was the only person in the program who was married with children. We were moving to one of the most expensive parts of the nation. We were nervous about whether or not I could perform. I mean, we were going to be studying and working with some of the sharpest people and some of the sharpest minds in the world. We were nervous about living in New England. We were going to be 1,000 miles away from our family and friends. No NASCAR, no college football, no barbecue, and worst of all, no sweet tea. Within a week of arriving in New Haven, Connecticut, my health utterly collapsed. I didn't know it at the time. It took several weeks to diagnose, but I had a severe acute case of ulcerative colitis. For the next 2 years, my doctors and I desperately tried anything and everything known, even experimental treatments. The Yale health plan felt more like the Yale death plan to me because my health got worse and worse. My weight went from 155 pounds down to a stooped, pale, hunched 128 pounds. One of my prescriptions was steroids, and the steroids were to strengthen my body and to give me energy and to help my body resist inflammation and to reduce the pain. But the steroids also transformed my personality so that I had a much, much shorter temper, and I was not any fun to live with. Our fear increased. Why in the world have we moved? Why in the world have we done this? Why has God called us to this? What is the point? We're trying to be obedient here, God, and this is what we get? We've moved halfway across the country. We've taken this step in faith. We don't know how we're going to pay for this. We're away from our family and friends, and now I'm sick and can barely function through the day, and my wife's trying to raise a 6-week-old and a 2-year-old by herself. This is what we get? For two long years worrying every day, any time that I stepped out of our apartment, wondering where the next bathroom was because I had no control over my intestines, wondering and worrying every day whether I could make it through that whole day without the cramping and the bleeding. 2 years. Every treatment imaginable. Until about 2 years later, I finally had surgery to have my entire colon, my entire large intestine removed. I became awake in the hospital after the surgery, trying to wean my body off steroids and morphine for the pain at the same time. I had tubes coming out of every hole in my body, plus a few new holes to boot. And I would wear a Ziploc bag, as I affectionately call it, in my midsection for the rest of my life. The fear was growing. I knew God had called us to this, but how could we possibly sustain it? Will I even live through this? What if I die? What will my wife do? What will my kids do? At the same time, my wife Anita had 2 miscarriages, one shortly before my surgery and one several months afterward. The one she had right before my surgery led her to be in the doctor's office down the same hall from where I lay in the hospital bed, having the procedure to remove the baby from her body. I tell you, the fear was more than I needed. Would I live or die? Would I see my girls married or graduated? The fear that somehow I had disobeyed God, that I had misread His intentions. And have you ever noticed that when things go wrong in your life, you have all those wonderful friends who tell you that you just don't have enough faith? Had I moved out of God's will in some way? How could being obedient to God be so awful and so difficult? The fear of the unknown was about more than I could take. Ironically, it was in that hospital bed with tubes coming out of all kinds of places that I experienced most this promise of God: I will never leave you nor forsake you. Early one morning, as I woke up, my closest friend, a Catholic priest who was in the program with me, sat in the room quietly reading the paper. He didn't say much. He was just there, and I didn't say much. I didn't have the energy, and frankly, I was frustrated and fried. I sensed the presence of God in the most powerful way that I ever have. As he sat there and I sat there, somehow our eyes locked and our hearts were joined, and as we prayed silently together, not knowing what the other was saying, but both of us lifting our hearts and our souls to God for a moment, the veil between heaven and earth was gone, and he was there. And the deep assurance came from above: I will never leave you nor forsake you. Place your hope solely in God. When you do, you will thereby discover life. True life, not from money, not from people, but from Him and no place else. When you grasp this one simple promise, your life truly will be different, because hope and life can be found nowhere else. Please pray with me. Gracious and eternal God, our lives, our hope, our destiny, our future and our world belong to you. Teach us to trust you rather than ourselves. Teach us to place our hope only in you. In the name of our risen Lord Jesus Christ, amen.
Now let's rejoin our host, Peter Wallace, and Alan Hunt for some final thoughts on this week's sermon.
Alan, thank you for your transparency in sharing your own experience in trusting this promise of God: I will never leave you nor forsake you. And having gotten to know you in these times together, I would have to say that your life is a clear example of what can happen when you truly rest in God's promises. But I have to say that your experience seems to be rare. What's holding the rest of us back from really believing what this verse said? I mean, how do we get this promise, as you put it, deep down in our knower?
I don't know that my experience is rare, Peter. I've known a lot of folks who get this better than I do. I've had a couple of moments in my life, two in particular, and I shared one in this message, where I just had that, as I described it, where the veil between heaven and this world was broken for a little while, and I just really sensed that eternal presence, that there's a real power in that. And again, I'm a fairly conventional guy. I think that you find that oftentimes when you're not looking for it, that you build the, as some old philosopher said, dig the well before you get thirsty. In the same way, if you practice the faith, if you spend time worshiping God on a regular basis and you spend time earnestly in prayer, and frankly, I think if you spend time being a giver and being a server in those settings and those experiences, you will have those breakthrough moments. I think it's when we try to force those moments and say, I really need that moment, that it was really the last thing on my mind. I was really in a bad place, as I described in this message. And so I really wasn't asking God for anything other than, God, I'm alone here and I'm kind of desperate. And that's when he responded. But I don't think there's an easy formula for it. I think it's you practice the faith, and that God, on occasion, oftentimes when you don't expect it, breaks in.
You explained that when we get this promise, it changes our lives. We should learn how to detach from things and attach to God, embrace simplicity, and trust the promise. That's clear and straightforward, but it's not easy.
Right.
In this culture, anyway.
Absolutely.
Do you have some practical advice for how we can detach from the things that tend to consume our time and energy and attention away from God and embrace this simpler life?
I think in the culture that we're in, where the average household is in debt, the average household has, I think, something like $9,000, $9,200 in credit card debt. We live in a culture that bombards us all day, every day with, you need this, you need that. If you don't buy this, you won't be whole. If you buy this, you'll find satisfaction and contentment. and it requires significant effort. And so to take specific steps, Crown Bible Study is one wonderful example of that, that we've used at our church to help people understand that really the message is true, God is true, and that living simply does indeed bring more joy because you have less things that you have to worry about. You have less obligations that you have to worry about. And when you're out of debt, you don't have that pressure. You know, as Proverbs says, that, you know, the borrower is a slave to the lender. And to set yourself free from the world's values that the more you have, the more you matter, because every funeral I've been to, the family walks away from the funeral home trying to figure out what to do with the stuff of the person who just died, because that stuff in the end really didn't make much difference.
Alan, what's the one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind through this coming week?
God's promise is sure, Peter, that He is with you. He does not abandon you. And there is a real strength in that day in and day out in reminding ourselves of that. When we're in a fight with somebody, when we're being hurt, or when we're struggling financially, to remind ourselves that even in this, God is still with me. And even better, God lives forever. My citizenship, as Philippians says, my citizenship is in heaven. So ultimately, my ultimate allegiance is to God. There's a real power and a real freedom in that.
Alan Hunt, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Peter.
Day One brings you preachers from the United Methodist Church, the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, the Episcopal Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church USA, and the United Church of Christ. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media, the Reverend Canon Lewis Schudig, President. Donald Jones is our production supervisor and audio engineer, and Peter Wallace, our executive producer. It's been our joy to bring you today's program. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on day one and forever.